I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with tap to pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. So Money episode 1658, The Search for Enough, Smart Investments and Raising Grounded Kids, with Carl Richards, founder of The Behavior Gap and host of 50 Fires podcast.
You're listening to So Money with award-winning money guru Farnoosh Torabi. Each day, get a 30-minute dose of financial inspiration from the world's top business minds, authors, influencers, and from Farnoosh herself. Looking for ways to save on gas or double your double coupons? Sorry, you're in the wrong place. Seeking profound ways to live a richer, happier life? Welcome to So Money.
It was easier for us to find people with hardly anything that had enough, that felt that they personally had decided they had enough. They felt like they had enough than I could a centimillionaire or a billionaire that felt that way.
Welcome to So Money, everybody. I'm Farnoosh Torabi. We have the one and only Carl Richards on So Money. He is, for those of you who read the New York Times, he is the creator of the Sketch Guy column, which appeared weekly for a decade in the New York Times, where Carl would take on complex financial concepts and make them easy to understand through doodles and sketches. And that's what I love about Carl. He takes these very heavy and multifaceted financial topics, breaks them down for us with clarity and thoughtfulness. And today we pick up where we left off in 2017, last time Carl was on the show before the pandemic, before a lot of things changed in the world. And we're having more deep conversations about what it means to have enough investments versus expenses. These are two terms we throw around a lot. And ultimately, the definition is a personal one, he says. And how to raise children to become grounded adults who actually like what they do and don't arrive in their 20s having a quarter life crisis. In addition to being the creator of The Behavior Gap, Carl is a certified financial planner and the host of a new podcast called 50 Fires, Money and Meaning with Carl Richards. I'm actually on the show today, and you can listen to that episode. I'll put the link in our show notes. Carl has had many multifaceted people on his podcast so far, including a woman who is a diagnosed psychopath and how that actually helps her be a smart investor. We talk a little bit about that on So Money today as well. He's had on Morgan Housel and his wife, Gretchen Housel. Morgan is the author of The Psychology of Money, a super popular book. And I know there are so many podcasts to choose from. And if you're looking for another financial podcast, highly recommend 50 Fires. Here's Carl Richards. You were in New Zealand since we spoke?
We lived in New Zealand for 4 years since we spoke.
Oh my gosh. During the pandemic?
Well, I guess maybe it wasn't. We were there 2016 to 2020.
Oh my gosh.
And then a year in London during the pandemic and then back here.
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah. Carl Richards, welcome back to So Money.
So excited to be here.
So great to have you. You were here, it was 2017, so I guess you were in New Zealand. Wow. And you were still publishing your New York Times column, The Sketch Guy. That's just iconic. I mean, it's got to be going in like the Personal Finance Hall of Fame. Like that
is so
like,
nice of you.
It's so great. Yeah. So everybody, if you aren't familiar with Sketch Guy, it was a column in the New York Times. Carl would take these complex financial concepts and make them easy to understand. And I think you're still releasing these on X, aka Twitter, right? I was just stalking you a little bit on social media. Last time you were on the show, we talked a lot about your upbringing, your childhood, what has influenced you in your financial life. You told some really captivating stories about being a young boy, you know, living through your parents' divorce, your mom working really hard overtime. And that was kind of when you first started to feel financial fear. And now today you are somebody who probably one of the foremost experts on why we do the things we do with our money, how our mind works. And catch us up a little bit because you've got some exciting things going on. I want to talk about your podcast, 50 Fires, your life today financially.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. It's fun to relive those stories too. I was just having this conversation this morning. We had some friends in from out of town. And we were talking about how the word I used was interface, that money seems to be the interface between us and a lot of trauma, right? Like because that often trauma around, do I feel safe? Right? Do I feel like I have, do I feel like I am enough? Right? Do I feel like I've done enough? Do I feel like I've earned, like all these words we use? Do I feel like I've earned respect? Do I feel like, do I, and even like worth? Am I worth? What's my self-worth? What's my value? Like all these words are so laced with money talk, you know? And I think it's interesting just to think back to the stories we talked about last time with childhood. And I've come to understand that a bit better since, that just like not knowing, it wasn't that I was unsafe. It was that I didn't know.
Yeah.
And so not knowing and always wondering and not understanding that what we're talking about, because these are all feelings, right? Like what we're talking about here, like who let the feelings in? on the money discussion, you know, exactly. I thought it was supposed to be a math question. Mm-mm. You know?
Yeah. When you say interface, I often think of like the user experience.
Yeah.
It's different for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
And when you say enough, it's like, we add that to everything. It's like, am I earning? Yes. But is it enough? Okay. Now things are complicated.
Yeah.
I have, you know, I feel like I'm worthy, but is it enough? Okay. Now I don't know. So, you know, this enough word gets us into trouble. Yeah. Why do we keep going back to it? Like, what is it about this measure of enough that we just can't seem to get away from, especially when it has to do with our financial measurements?
Yeah, I think it's largely because nobody taught us what it actually means. I mean, I think when you think about enough and money, it cannot be a number. Like no number will ever be enough. If you're crazy in your relationship with money, more money won't solve that problem. Like that's proven to be true. And so money, enough can't be a number. I don't think it can be a place you can arrive. I don't think it can be a destination. I think enough is something you only can be. Like you have to have enough now in order for you to have enough in the future. And that's really like, what in the world are you talking about, right? That feels like drum circle and patchouli oil talk. And you're like, in the end, we gave money a job that it can't do. Like money can't do that job. It's a different job. Now, can money set up the conditions under which enoughness might be more or less possible? Sure. Like, I think we could all argue that, like, if certain things aren't taken care of, then it's hard to have this philosophical discussion or do the other kind of work that I would point to more like as therapy, right? Like, but maybe money can establish conditions under which enoughness could be easier. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I say that, I know tons of people with, as part of the 50 Fires project, we were thinking about trying to find what I called the wizards of enough. I was like, I've run into a few of them. They're always like hiding under bridges or, you know, like in forests, like they're hard to find.
In a meditative state. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like wizard. They're in caves. They're like the wizards of enough. And we were thinking about, okay, could we find a billionaire that's a wizard of enough? And we're like, I don't know. But I knew I could find people with hardly anything. It was easier for us to find people with hardly anything that had enough, that felt that they personally had decided they had enough. They felt like they had enough than I could a centimillionaire or a billionaire that felt that way. That's interesting.
It's interesting. And I can kind of see why, because someone who would aspire to earn billions, what that takes, that desire, it's restlessness. It's like a financial restlessness, you know, like, mm-hmm. Yes, maybe there are other things associated with the achievement of making $1 billion. That's, you know, you're looking for that sort of achievement, that validation, that win. It's an adrenaline rush. It's a thing you want to prove, but also like, wow, that has to be like just this really perpetual nagging voice in your head that's like more, 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 more. Because you could have stopped at 7 million, but you kept going to 70 and then 700 and now 7 billion. Like, what is that about? What is that about? Yeah. Have you studied that?
Yeah. I think it's often that's the byproduct of somebody just being insanely, like we all know these people. And in many cases, we're glad they exist, right? Like the change they've made in the world. And it can be a byproduct, but then you've got the people who it was literally just about money. And I don't know. I just know that for most of us, enough can't. What's that great story? I can't remember who it was. Vonnegut, I think, at a party, right? Mm-hmm. And at a party at a billionaire's house, talking with another author, and the other author said something like, "Hey, how does it feel to know that this guy makes more in a day than you'll make in your lifetime?" And Vonnegut, or whichever one, I'm sure I'm messing this up, said, "Well, I have something they can never have." I was like, "What?" And he said, "Enough."
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
You know, super interesting.
Really, really good. You brought up 50 Fires. This is a really cool podcast that you're hosting. It's a different pace for you. I feel like you're really going so, so, so deep. I mean, you are always this like philosophical, thoughtful writer and thinker in the world of finance. But this podcast, I feel like you're having a lot of fun. You're tackling some really interesting concepts. Like, everybody go back and listen to this one episode about being a sociopath, and you actually interview somebody who's a self-identifying sociopath, psychopath.
And fully diagnosed.
Yeah. Fully diagnosed, right? Not just like what they think they are. Yeah. And the surprising takeaways, like, you're really fascinated with investing. You teach a lot about investing. You're a certified financial professional. And part of that conversation that you had with,
Jamie.
Jamie, right? Who wrote the book Confessions of a Sociopath under a pseudonym, hugely popular book that came out in 2014. That Jamie has a really actually healthy approach to investing. Let's talk about that. Let's shift gears a little bit to some more of like Carl's tactical advice and observations about what it actually takes to be a good investor.
Yeah.
Lessons from a sociopath, maybe.
No, it was great. And she, just so everybody knows these terms, the term sociopath and psychopath, she taught me are interchangeable. And she typically refers to herself as a psychopath because that's the way most people internationally use the phrase. So it was interesting to come after my wife listened to that episode. She said, like, hey, can we decide what parts of our lives we're going to treat like psychopaths? Like, and then she was like Jamie, the psychopath, because I'm sure all psychopaths are not the same, but Jamie, because she is incredibly like one of the smartest people I've ever talked to.
Wow.
But she's also like part of being, according to her, part of being a psychopath is this lack of empathy and empathetic connection to others. And so there's not a lot of feelings in the way. And so it was really interesting to see like an example, she fully funded her retirement by age 30 because, and this is really classic. I mean, for the listeners, like think of how many 27-year-olds, you know, that would say this. I learned about compound interest, so I could think of no better use for money as a 27-year-old. And I was like, you're the first 27-year-old in the history of the world that right. couldn't think of something better to do with money at age 27. So, the other thing that's interesting is once she learned how to invest correctly, you know, low cost, being diversified, all of those things. It turns out there's a set of principles around investing. You don't have to wango pango and do whatever your friends tell you. There's actually a set of principles. Once she learned those principles, she said like, oh yeah, last time I checked my account 3 years ago. And now we're like 20 years later, this is a bunch of money. She was like, last time I checked it 3 years ago. And she's like, oh, and the time before that was 8 years ago. So I was like, wait, let me get this straight. You've checked your investment account one time in 11 years. And I was like, do you know most people check it that many times every day? And she said, well, why would you do that? And she's right. You know, like we all know the secret to investing is like get the foundations right. But the secret is time. Yeah. Secret's not skill. The secret's time. And so if you're running out, like you would never plant a tree and then dig it up every month to see if the roots are growing. What Jamie's saying is, well, I read somewhere that compounding was the secret. Time is the secret to compounding. Why would I possibly look at it? And she's right. So those are some of the things. My wife is like, what if we just check the mail once?
Yeah. What if I just went on Instagram once in a year? Oh my gosh.
Oh, you listen to this one, the food one. Yeah. I think she goes to Costco once a month with a specific shopping list.
Oh my God.
She buys the same shopping list once a month. Then she eats it in perishable. Like, so week one is this, week two is this, week three is this. So she thought about this once. Still has a varied diet because it's week by week. It's just so interesting. How many things do we spend as it relates to money? How many things do we spend thinking about over and over and over? Should I pay off the credit card bill? Should I not pay off the? All the mental energy we spend on that stuff, she doesn't spend. So that's why we called that episode Invest Like a Psychopath.
Yeah. There's actually another book coming out this year. It was in the Wall Street Journal, an excerpt on it's called Sociopath, a memoir. So there's culturally we're very interested in this diagnosis. Yeah. You bring up your wife quite a bit, even when you're on my podcast, which is airing today, by the way, this, our podcast, we sort of did a swap and, I had the honor of being on 50 Fires. And by the way, what's the title about 50 Fires? What does that stand for?
Yeah, it's so funny. I was just up looking at it. We're building a fire pit in the backyard. And in episode two with my friend Bryce, I said, yeah, like I just want to keep having these kind of conversations, the kind you'd have around a fire. In fact, we're building a fire pit. I want to have 50 fires a year around. And he's like, that's the name of your show.
Oh my gosh.
It's the kind of conversations you'd have around a fire with a friend.
Well, and
in the West.
What an honor to be on one of the first 50 on the podcast this year. Well, you mentioned, we talked about our spouses and you even when we talked in 2017, you mentioned the benefits of being married to your wife as it pertains to your financial relationships and you having sort of a more scarcity mindset. She's more risk prone and she's an entrepreneur and like it kind of works. And you also said on that podcast that you know, one of the things you feel luckiest about is the people in your life that have sort of shown up and helped you out and ushered you through life. And I feel the same way too. It's actually quite incredible that the number of people have just sort of like offered to mentor me or guide me or give me wisdom when they didn't even think they were really helping me, but I was just listening and it helped me at the right time. How important are relationships as it pertains to the health of your financial life, like who you marry, who you work for, your friendships? Steve Harvey said, and I quote, I know, getting really profound here. He said something like, you know, if 8 of your friends are broke, you're going to be number 9. You know, and so it's funny, but like, you shouldn't value your friends just on their financial acuteness. There's something there. Like basically the community that we build, the relationships that we have, and what we can learn from each other financially.
Yeah, there's two things that come to mind. One is the quickest way to change a habit is to hang out with people who have that habit, which I like. If I can, the role of identity, how you identify in relationship to your habits, like if I think of myself as a runner, then of course in the morning when I get up, I put on my shoes and I go running. Why am I going running? Because that's what runners do.
Yeah.
And so like there's a chicken and an egg problem, but you can just simply raise your hand and say, I'm the kind of person who saves 10% of my income a month. Well, why am I saving 10%? Because that's what I do. I'm a saver. I see myself. I'm a long-term investor. Well, I put $50 a month into a S&P 500 index fund and I let it go. And why do I do that? Because that's what I am. Like, so the role of identity, well, one way to reinforce identity is hang out in groups that are like you. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like just in terms of habit formation, I think that can be really valuable. And then the second thing that I've learned a lot from 50 Fires, because a lot of the conversations I'm having are with an age cohort so far. There's been an age, you're probably among the younger of the age cohort. But there's a lot of people who were grew up pre Instagram, pre internet, even. And they say, I remember Dean Norris, who's Hank at Breaking Bad. He was like, oh yeah, my buddies and I used to get together and ride our bikes. He's like, we didn't know. And so I grew up, I may have wanted a slightly better dirt bike, but I didn't know that I was supposed to want a jet.
Right.
And so I think like, I call that cultivating your comparison set. So my comparison set was my buddies on my block. There was no other comparison set. I didn't know anything else existed, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Now your comparison set is literally the Kardashians. Right? Like you feel like, well, it's normal for them and it's normal for them and it's normal. So I think if you are really careful, like if you think carefully, like a little bit like a garden even, like how would I cultivate a garden if I wanted things to grow? If you can be careful about what you're allowing yourself to view as something that you compare yourself to, that I think can have a huge role in, like, if I'm hanging out with the right kind of people, you know, if everybody I hang out with wants a Ferrari as a daily driver, that can be really problematic if I don't like, but if everybody I hang out with is fine with their Toyota 4Runner, that's a different set of comparisons. I think that's really, really important. So in terms of identity, habit formation, and then cultivating your comparison set.
Where you live is so important too. Like you've chosen to live in some interesting places. You talked about New Zealand. You're currently in Utah, which I think is where your roots are.
Yeah.
In terms of where we choose to settle down.
Such a big deal.
Right? Cost of living, of course. But also as you talk about, you know, the influences, the comparisons, the culture.
Such a big deal. Two quick stories. One you know, you always think as parents, you'll hear this a lot from parents. So we have 4 kids, they're all adults now. And there's this real temptation to want to, you know, help them get into a house in a neighborhood, a great neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And the research is pretty clear on this, that like, that's a well-intentioned behavior that produces suboptimal results typically. because you may help them, you know, scrounge and save and really stretch and get into this great neighborhood. But now they're in a neighborhood where the furnishings in those houses, the cars people drive, the activities those people do are a stretch, and they're going to be stretching the rest of their lives. And so that's one interesting way to think about, like, where you live, like, it couldn't, especially early, right? If you're like stretching early and you never get off that treadmill, it's super hard. And then to realize, and there's obviously trade-offs, right? Like, we lived in London for a year. It's really expensive to live in London, but man, it was amazing to walk everywhere and the conversations we had, and on a single walk hear 7 different languages spoken. You know, I don't have that in parts of Utah. I don't think when I go on a walk, I hear any other language. So optimizing, like, just, I think the way I like to think about it is just be intentional about those decisions, because there are certainly trade-offs. Are you aware? I just had my 27-year-old daughter on 50 Fires. I think that's the episode that goes out tomorrow or Wednesday. And she has intentionally made a decision to live in New York. She works in distressed equity. She could work from anywhere for her job, but she finds that she's at the center of a lot of conversations that she has more conversations in a week than she would have in a year somewhere else. Well, she's aware that that trade-off's costing her something. And one way to frame this would be value capture. I love thinking through, like, what's the value you're capturing from that trade-off? Mm-hmm. So you can start to decide, is it an expense or is it an investment? And if we get those wrong, we make really some big mistakes. But so my daughter's framed it as like, that's actually an investment that will most likely have, I will most likely capture value even economically over my career because I'm involved in those discussions now. Right. And the value could have been like, I just really love living here right now. It could be non-economic. It's okay. That's totally okay. It's just being clear about what's the value you're capturing out of the experience of where you're living.
It's smart.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You want to know what's worse than shopping for jeans? Shopping for bras. It's never been fun for me until Third Love came into my life. Third Love was launched to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. They make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen probably since high school and have straps that actually stay put. Third Love's bras are designed at their headquarters in San Francisco, and they're made from premium materials. They put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before they're given the stamp of approval. And whether you're a AA or an H cup, their virtual fitting room can help find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups, so long feeling stuck between two cup sizes that just don't fit. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with the code podcast15. That's thirdlove.com to get $15 off your order with the code podcast15. Yeah, I felt the same way as a journalist coming to New York, even invested in graduate school here. I don't know if I would do that again now, given the cost of going to journalism school today versus what it was 20 years ago. But even then, it was a stretch. But the benefit of that, the cost benefit analysis, was for me like a faster track to making really important relationships, jobs that would give me responsibilities that were, you know, huge learning curves, but allowed me to advance in my career much faster, make more money. I mean, one person just said it. It was a career expert I interviewed years ago, and she said, if you ever have the opportunity to work in New York City, which is at the time, and maybe even still the highest cost of living city in America, maybe rivaling San Francisco, do it. Even if it's just for a year, because what you're essentially doing is you are raising your salary profile, you know, having lived in New York and worked in New York rather. And I don't know now with how it's changed with remote work and remote living, but back then it was like, you have New York on your resume. You've worked sort of in the big leagues, and that comes with a premium. The next person that hires you, who may not be in New York, it's outside New York, but she was just like, invest even a little bit in New York. And so I always, you know, in certain industries, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I would just frame that. I think it's been insanely helpful for me to ask the question, is this an investment or is this an expense? Mm-hmm. Expenses are things I want to eliminate or pay as little as possible. Investments are things that I want, like they regenerate a return. Now, like I'll give you a crazy example. My strength coach, when I first hired my strength coach, it was for some rehab. Mm-hmm. But when the rehab was over, I was like, wow, this is really expensive.
Right.
But I started looking at my results at not just like how I felt better, but actually like work. I was like more productive. Mm-hmm. I couldn't, at first it took my wife to say, well, that could be like, what changes have you made? And so now I've reframed, like my strength coach is an investment. It's not an expense. And often investments are like, look, I want to spend as much money as I can if it's still to the point where, you know, when the marginal returns start diminishing. So anyway, I think just framing things, is it an investment or is it an expense? And you could, you know, I had this conversation with Ramit. And, you know, Ramit would make an argument that a cashmere sweater is an investment because nothing touches this body but cashmere.
You can trick. The mind is an easily trickable thing. Like you can.
Cute story, Carl.
Cute story, right? Or like people are like, a Rolex is an investment. So then that's fine. But then you're like, you're not investing for retirement. So like, I'm just not sure I'm following.
I agree. But I think your New York example is a nice example of like, some people would be like, that's just such a silly waste of money.
Yeah,
what an expense. And other people would say that's an investment. And I think you're right. I wish there was a clear cut rule. So be careful, but it's helpful framing.
Yeah. With traditional investing in the stock market, you are still running the Society of Advice. Is that still up and running? Great. Yeah. This is a secret society of real financial advisors. And, you know, Carl, one of the most common questions I get from our community, our listeners, is it worth it to work with a financial professional? As so many people aren't looking for advice around which mutual funds to buy. They need a plan. They want to know if they're going to be able to retire. They want to be able to save for their children's college education. And so a lot of advisors, they might charge, you know, that AUM, that percentage of assets under management. It just feels like a very like antiquated way of working with people as far as what they are looking for today. Mm-hmm. And so first of all, what kind of changes do you see happening in the industry that might kind of speak to that? And then for somebody who is like wondering, what's the investment here that what's the return that I should be looking for in working with a planner? How do I justify the cost? What would you say?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, first, like deep empathy to everybody who asked that question, because it's hard to navigate the advice, speaking broadly, the advice industry with 20 years of experience from the inside. It's hard to navigate. And from the outside, I'm just like, I have no idea how you know. So here's what I would point to in terms of value. All the tactical stuff, if you sort of know what you want, all the tactical stuff is pretty easy. I don't know that I'd use the word easy, but pretty simple. Mm-hmm. The question to me is aligning those tools. And I would say this, aligning your use of capital. And I, capital, I always asterisk time, money, energy, and attention. It's four sources of capital. So aligning your use of capital with what's important to you. And I think of that as a Venn diagram. Like there's two circles, use of capital, what's important to you. We want as much overlap as possible. That to me is what real financial planning is about. And that takes a series of conversations that very few. And so this is how I would like Ron Lieber at the New York Times. And I tried to write probably six different times, like how to find a financial planner column. It's hard because as soon as you write like the checklist, you find some example of somebody who met the checklist and is stealing money from little ladies, right? Like it's metaphorically. Well, actually, anyway,
literally,
maybe literally. Yeah. So what I think the best approach is find, have some conversations with people who, and you can use some basic stuff, right? Like maybe they have their CFP is a good, like first clean swap. You know, maybe they call themselves a fiduciary. There may be some good first, just clean, like criteria, but more important is, are these people interested in understanding what you're trying to do? You use the word plan and like, why, what is this about? Are they asking those kind of questions? Because if you walk in, what you're typically going to have is this, they're going to chuck prescriptions at you.
Yeah.
Right. Like you should take they're going to try and sell you stuff. And what you want to know is, have they taken the time to diagnose? And a diagnosis would feel like you would get asked questions that you haven't even thought of. You would have, if you're with a spouse or a partner, you'd probably right there learn things like, whoa, I didn't know you felt that way. Because it doesn't really matter which ladder you climb up, to paraphrase an old Covey quote, right? Like it doesn't really matter, like building the best ladder, buying the best ladder, arguing about the best ladder. Here's a better example. So much of it is about arguing over whether you're going to take a plane, a train, or an automobile on a trip. Like that's typically your experience with financial advice. This one's better. This one's better. This one's better. I read about this in the news that like the Financial Pornography Network is waving their hands about this one. It doesn't really matter whether you're taking a plane, train, or an automobile on a trip if you haven't decided first, like, where do you want to go? And so a real advisor or a real planner will walk you through those conversations about where you want to go. If you don't get a sense that they have any idea of your desired future state, what's the point? Run. So that's my only advice there. Because, well, the ones that are good at that are worth their weight in gold. That's why it's called a secret society. They're just kind of hard to find.
Yeah. Do you see a bit of a change in the marketplace in terms of fee structure, and are advisors open to being flexible as far as like what they're charging and how they charge?
Yeah. So I think this conversation is incredibly important. And I think it's even more important to get right first. Like, what is it that you're paying for?
Right.
So like, that's the conversation that to me, like is really changing quickly, is like more transparency on what it is you're paying for and what the value is. And then how advisors charge, of course, tons of flexibility. We're seeing people change to hourly rates. We're seeing monthly retainers. We're seeing annual retainers. In some cases, an AUM fee is the best way to pay. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that I am adamant about is, look, we could get in debates about how you pay, but the one thing I'm adamant about is that you understand what you are paying. And that's always been a huge problem, is like the historically advisors have found historically the industry, speaking broadly, including advisors, have found the as many ways as possible to hide fees. Well, a real financial advisor doesn't do that. So whether they're charging an AUM or retainer, a monthly or an hourly fee, we want it to be transparent so you know what you're paying for. So you can make a decision like, wow, they've added this much value in my life, no problem. Or, geez, I don't really get that much value. I'm out of here. That's the important part to me. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you. It's okay. It's an honest answer, and it's the right answer. I think there's such an underserved market of people who, you know, there's this perception that I'm only eligible to work with a financial advisor until I've made it. I've made a lot of money. It's sort of like a rich person's service, as opposed to somebody who is building wealth or trying to build wealth. I think there's a real opportunity there for financial planners, frankly, to address those those people.
Let me just real fast, like that's really important, right? Like amen to that. It's a problem in the industry. It's probably the most common conversation I have about the future of advice among advisors and advisor conferences is like, how do we address that? And so yes, yes, and yes.
When I was on your show, you talked about you have four children, and even now you mentioned one of your daughters in New York City. Your kids, they're doing awesome. I mean, you must be a really proud dad. Mm-hmm. Any advice for the parents in the audience who want to try to, you know, raise kids who, and this isn't even about like feeling financially successful. That's a never-ending journey, but like just feeling like they're doing work that's meaningful to them. So many young people right now arriving at adulthood, like I did all the right things and I don't feel happy, or I'm in debt and I went to college and I can't find a job. And they're just like, they feel as though they've been fed a false bill of goods, you know, do all these things, buy the house, and then take out the student loans, et cetera. And, you know, we know how that usually ends. And so I don't know, in hindsight, do you feel like you may have had played a role in some of the reasons why your kids grew up to be pretty centered and seemingly like off to great starts in their careers and adult lives?
Well, that's really nice of you. We're super proud of our kids, and I'm pretty clear. And this would like the only thing I wish I had done differently was like, if I could go back 20 years, I would just tell myself to relax a bit, relax, like let them be, like, you know what I mean? Like we joke about having free range kids, and we're like, that's one thing we did a pretty good job of, like, but I have very little to do with it. I mean, I think my wife has a lot to do with where the kids are, but even she has very little to do with it. I think like, but some of the things that do matter, and I just had my daughter, I think I just mentioned that, my daughter's on the episode that's coming out soon. We had a lot of conversations around this value capture idea. Like, what is it, for instance, like I got to choose at school between getting a job at the local coffee shop, or there's this, I could be part of the venture capital, like the venture capital investment fund at campus. This was a real example for my daughter. And, you know, we would have that conversation of like, well, if you get the job making $17 an hour, that's going to generate what for you? Like, what would you capture back? She's like, well, I need a little spending money. Okay. What would the other one do? Well, geez, it really set me up for like so much in my career. Well, which one's more valuable? Is there another way to solve the spending money problem? I mean, so we had a lot of those conversations. Like, what are you trying to cap? You know, I want to make an impact on the environment. One of our kids was super interested in water issues in the West. Mm-hmm. And she looked at two different programs. One, without being specific, one was in the social science building and one was in the engineering building. And we said, well, okay, let's just think about like at the end, the investment you'd make in this degree, which one's going to give you a set of tools to put you in conversations that are going to have the bigger impact, the social science building maybe, or the engineering building maybe. And she decided engineering was going to put her in a different, but she could have decided the other one. But it's like, have those conversations around, are we sure that, you know, XYZ private college is that return? What's the return you're hoping for?
Right.
Because we have a lot of evidence now that the return's not necessarily going to be income. Like the income profile between the state school in Montana and the private school in Vermont, you know, it's not going to make a big, huge difference. And the student loan debt could, assuming you were in-state student in Montana, you know, so just be, we joke around here that like, count the cost. Just like, it's no fun. It's often my kids would be like, you've ruined everything. I'm like, well, no, we're just trying to count the cost.
Right, right.
And maybe the cost is worth it. Maybe it's not. But let's do that before you wake up with $400,000 in student loan debt.
Yes, yes. Amen. I did that as an adult woman. running a business. I count the cost of what it will take to grow my business. Do I want to do that thing, which might make more money, but then what is the cost of that pursuit in my personal life, in my time, as you mentioned?
So smart.
It's not just value, it's not just money, right? It's like your energy, your time, your relationships even. I appreciate that. I think that is the right kind of thinking. And to be able to flex that at a young age, basically the beauty of it, really what you're asking your kids is, what do you want?
Mm-hmm.
What would, you know, and at least I know for young girls, because in our patriarchy, like, you're not really like allowed to want for things as much as, you know, the boys, you know, you feel like you have to really have justifications for everything. And it just feels hard to just say out loud, like, I want to be rich, or I want a big career, or I want to start a business. So I like that you're giving kids, young people, permission, and adults, their parents, to lead them down those paths.
Yeah, that's, I guess, one thing I am super proud of, and I didn't have anything really to do with it, but our three daughters are killing it, right?
Yeah.
It's so fun to see, like, two of them in engineering school, one in deep bro distressed equity land. Like, of the three firms she applied to, there was no women on the whole list.
Well, and that's a secret. P.S. Go where you don't see yourself.
I know. She just,
it's scary, but.
Yeah, she's scared, but she's just doing it. And the two engineers and one off to med school, and they are unapologetic about it. And I have deep empathy about the struggle. I mean, just because I've heard the stories from my wife and my episode with my wife, she brought it up. I didn't really realize it was I learned things about my wife after 27 years on that podcast interview. I learned things about her that I didn't know about this struggle. So, you know, I'm not diminishing the struggle in any way. And I'm so glad my daughters are just like, and they bump up against it all the time. It's amazing. Like, I can't believe the stories I hear from my distressed equity daughter, you know, and even the biomed engineering daughters that are both like, I can't believe we're still talking about this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it, and you're going to get out of my way.
Right.
It's really great.
50 Fires, everybody. Podcast is focused on money and meaning. You get Carl, you get his family, you get these wizards. I'm on it.
You're on it.
I'm on it.
So for sure. Yeah.
And it's been so lovely to catch up with you. You have so many interesting things going on. What do you do for fun?
Spent lots of time in the mountains, the high mountains. My skis and climbing and lots of time trying to navigate uncertain landscapes.
Which we talked about in the first episode. If you go, I'll put that in our show notes, the power, the importance of living life, you know, getting comfortable with uncertainty.
For sure.
Superpower. Carl Richards, thank you.
Cheers, Farnoosh. That was so fun.
Thanks again to Carl for joining us. Links to his previous appearance on So Money in our episode notes, as well as where you can listen to his new podcast, 50 Fires. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you back here on Friday for Ask Farnoosh. I hope your day is so money. Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person, contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.